Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking a bit about the coal industry, about safety of miners, and also about environmental impacts, something, at least miner safety, something that people have now been talking about on the national level for several weeks. Earlier this month, I'm sure you'll remember, 13 coal miners in West Virginia died after they were trapped by an explosion inside the Sago mine. Apparently, federal inspectors had cited this mine many times, in fact, over 200 times last year for safety violations, giving it the worst record of any mine of its size in the state of West Virginia. The question is that typical, or is there something unusual about that? And has the industry and the government failed in the effort to keep miners safe? This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Jeff Goodell. He's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. He's also a frequent contributor to the New York Times magazine. He's written on this before. He's the author of a New York Times bestseller entitled Our Story, 77 Hours That Tested Our Friendship and Our Faith, which was based on another kind of a story where miners were trapped underground. His first book was The Cyber Thief and the Samurai, which was about the hunt for the notorious computer hacker Kevin Mitnick. He's also written a memoir entitled Sunnyvale, The Rise and Fall of a Silicon Valley Family. And he is the author of a book that's due to be published this spring, which is titled Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. It will be published by Houghton Mifflin, and it's expected that it will be out and in the bookstores early in May. He is joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions and comments will be welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, people have questions and comments, you're certainly welcome to call. You just ask that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many callers as possible, keep the program moving. But again, anybody's welcome. Again, the number here locally, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Goodell, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Just to talk specifically about Sago and about what happened there. After, in some of the stories that we have seen after the accident, there apparently were the mine was apparently cited for a number of safety violations. And as I said, and you can tell me if I have that right, at least in one of the stories, it said that it had the worst record of any mine of its size in the state of West Virginia. Are you familiar with that mine particularly, or at least I'm sure that you've seen what has been read, what has been written about it afterwards. Was it that bad?
Well, I have never been in that mine, and I wasn't really familiar with that mine. There's, you know, as you know, thousands of underground coal mines in Appalachia, but it really was that bad. And I think that, unfortunately, you know, we're starting to see that that the enforcement of mine safety regulations in recent years has not been as tough as it should be. And you know, the surprising thing I think that's come out is that that a lot of people didn't know, and is really even shocking to me, because to see it in this context, is that, you know, these fines for some of these, they had over 200 federal citations against it, and the fines for many of these, the penalties for many of these infractions were like, you know, $60, $80, and, you know, that's quite shocking.
In fact, it seems that in a lot of the stories that I've read about this, the allegation is made that companies find it more cost-effective, sad to put it in those terms, but more cost-effective to pay the fines rather than to correct the problems that they're being cited for.
Right. I mean, when you have, I think that the most that coal company that owned the Sago mine paid for any fine was about $200, a little over $200. I mean, that's not even a traffic citation. And so, you know, it's very easy to justify, you know, just letting the stuff go. And unfortunately, that, you know, puts miners' lives at risk.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess the next question would be, this kind of pattern, is that typical or is it atypical?
Well, I think we've certainly seen a rollback in enforcement broadly under the Bush administration of mine safety rules. I think that there's been an effort to streamline a lot of regulations. Dave Lariski, who was the head of the Mine Safety and Health Administration until very recently, a Bush appointee, made it very clear that he was interested in not so much interested in enforcement, but more interested in helping coal companies work to understand safety rules better. And, you know, they've cut back on mine safety enforcement officials. I think it's part of a broad regulatory rollback you've seen under the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm. So maybe you could talk a little bit about who makes the rules and then who is responsible for enforcing them.
Well, there's the rules. The main agency that's in charge of mine safety is the Mine Safety and Health Administration, MSHA, which is a federal agency under the Department of Labor. The federal inspector, there are federal inspectors appointed to each mine, and they make routine investigations, routine inspections of the mine. There's also state inspectors, but it's really the federal agency that has the real power to possibly shut down a mine if they think it's dangerous. And it's a very difficult thing to generalize about because it varies depending on the type of inspector, the type of mine, and things like that. But when you have this sort of broad regulatory rollback from the top, it sends a signal all the way down the line.
Mm. Well, is the problem that the inspections aren't being done or that inspections are being done and then if the mines are cited for violations, then no one is really going back to make sure that either the no one's going back to make sure that the problems are actually getting taken care of?
Well, the inspections are certainly getting done. I think the issue is you know, as we said at the beginning, is are the penalties enough that the mine operators really care about it? I mean, if you have over 200 citations in 1 year, but it only costs you a couple $1,000s, you know, there's a lot of money to be made in coal right now. And the key to understanding the way this business works is to realize that coal is a commodity. It is something that is, you know, priced per pound, and every penny that they have to spend on safety improvements and things like that comes out of the bottom line. And it really is a commodity business. And a lot of coal operators look at some of these safety improvements as coming out of their profits, and they don't like that.
Hmm. Is there anything that stands out, anything that's typical? We talk about violations that you see a lot from one place to the next. I mean, really, what is it that we're talking about?
Well, I mean, I think broadly what we're talking about, the big thing that's going on right now is that there's coal prices have gone way up. And so there's a lot of smaller mines that are opening, a lot of marginal operations that are beginning to open now. And one of the other broad trends that's really important to put this story in context is that, especially in Appalachia, they've been mining coal there for 150 years. And the easy coal, the simple-to-get coal, is gone. And the coal they're going after now is getting increasingly deep, increasingly complicated to go after, and increasingly dangerous, despite the fact that mine technology has improved. There's much better roof bolting and much better miners, and there's lots of technological improvements. But the fact is certain regions of the country, especially the region where the Sago mine was, is getting more and more mined out, and that just makes it more and more difficult and dangerous.
Mm. I guess that I'm sure that people understand that coal mining is a dangerous occupation, one of the most dangerous, and has been for a long time. And in certain parts of the world, it's even worse, even more dangerous, if you can imagine that, than here in the United States. But having said that, then, though, it sounds as if you're saying that, yes, it's dangerous, it's always been dangerous, but you think that it is more dangerous now than it has been in the past?
Well, I think that talking about the danger of coal mining is a lot like talking about how dangerous it is to be a police officer. If you're on a patrol in a shopping mall in Beverly Hills, you're probably pretty safe. On the other hand, if you're doing an undercover drug bust in the Bronx or somewhere like that, it's very dangerous. And I think that, you know, broadly across America, a lot of coal mining has moved to large strip mines, which have their own environmental problems, mountaintop removal and things like that. But those are, by and large, much safer. And so you see improvements in the broad safety trends in coal mining in America, and there's no doubt about that. And there's been a lot of, technology and regulations that have been put in place. I think where the real danger is in these mined-out regions in Appalachia, where you're seeing marginal coal mines being reopened by companies who are interested in making a quick buck off of the rising coal prices and putting workers at risk.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Jeff Goodell. He's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine, has also been a frequent contributor to the New York Times magazine, and he's the author of a book that's scheduled to come out later this year in May, a book entitled Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future, and it's something that he's written a bit about before. Questions here, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to talk with in Urbana, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You've been wondering how widespread it is. I can address the issue in Illinois. My son-in-law worked for coal mines in southern Illinois near Assessor, owned by Standard Oil of Ohio, their shaft mines. And he has just stood there and heard the mine manager tell the inspector, hell, I don't care what you write up. We'll pay the fine. It's cheaper.
Right. I mean, that's really...
It's prevalent everywhere there are shaft mines.
Right. I mean, I think that goes to the heart of the issue is, you know, if it's only going to cost them $60 or $80 or $100 for one of these interactions.
A lot more than that, and they'd still do it. A lot more than that.
Well, you know...
And
yeah.
It's not just down in Appalachia, and it's right here in Illinois.
Right. No,
well,
I think.
Thank you. I'm glad you're bringing this forth.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the call. You want to expand on that at all, Jeff? Comment on that, Jeff?
Well, I mean, I do think that this is the in a certain way, as far as mine safety goes, the heart of the issue is that the history of coal mining has shown that it's been over 100,000 people miners have died in coal mines in the United States since 1900. I mean, it is a very long bloody history, and mining reform has been very, very difficult. Every time there's a mine disaster, there's calls for reform. But the coal industry is very politically powerful, and they manage to neuter a lot of these reforms. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens after this, to what degree politicians and people are going to tolerate this kind of danger.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose they're balancing interests here. On the one hand, the safety of mine workers, it becomes an issue when a high-profile story like this comes along. But as you've also written, because of concerns about meeting our needs for energy, the price of natural gas, the availability of oil, the market, the attractiveness of coal is growing. And so there'll be these two competing pressures. One would be those people who are interested in mine safety, and then those other people who are interested in meeting a need for energy, and I suppose within the industry, obviously, there's the interest in making money.
Right. I mean, it's very important for sort of America's economic future that we figure out a way to use coal and use it safely and environmentally as least damaging a way as possible, and to deal with coal's contribution to global warming. I mean, I think that we have an incredible bounty of coal in America, but that doesn't, give coal operators license to, bend the rules and things like that. And I think that there's going to be a lot of hard thinking about this in the future as oil prices rise, natural gas prices rise, and coal comes under more and more scrutiny. I mean, one of the things that's happened is that coal has sort of been forgotten about for years, and a lot of the stuff, people just haven't been paying attention to it, and now all of a sudden, it's back in the limelight in a lot of ways, and I think you're going to see more and more questions being raised about a lot of things.
All right, let's talk with somebody in Bloomington, Indiana, line number four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. It seems to me that one big problem of mine safety is the hostility between the mine laborers and the mine owners. The miners and the mine owners don't like each other. And yet there's something special about communities of miners, these Appalachian people, where you have a community of miners. They're often a close-knit community. They're not hard to love. I've been among them. They're people that kind of come to your heart. And it seems to me we could capitalize on that. If the mine owners could see how lovable, and now sometimes they're not lovable. They can curse and they can be, but sometimes you can find something to love in them and therefore have a real heartfelt emotional reason to provide for their safety.
Well, Mr. Goodell, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, the relationship between mine owners and miners, you know, has been, you know, obviously full of battles. The labor battles in the coal industry are among the bloodiest in American labor history, and it runs very deep. And your caller is absolutely right. I mean, there is no love lost in most places between coal operators and the coal miners. And, you know, one of the things that makes coal mining dangerous in many regions, especially in Appalachia and in Illinois, as coal begins to, mines are beginning to open up again, is, you know, the coal industry has been very good at running the labor union, the miner workers union, out of the industry. They've really broken the union. And there's complicated reasons for that, and the miners union has its own problems. But what it comes down to, and I've talked to many, many miners about this, is that in a non-union mine, you know, if you feel you're in danger, and you say, "Look, I don't want to go in there. I think the roof is going to fall. I think there's too much water." Whatever you problem you raise, they'll just say, "Well, you don't want to go in. Fine, we'll get somebody else." You know, and the coal miners really don't have a voice, someone to stand up for them right now, especially as you know MSHA. Weakens its regulations.
It seems to me that if some mine owner would really embrace the miners community around him, I think they could love each other. And one of the ways they could do that is when somebody says, "I don't want to go into the mine because there's too much water or the roof is weak or whatever," and the mine owner shows some compassion, some concern. And maybe even asks the miner to suggest how the problem could be solved, and then takes his advice, and this relationship could be healed some. I think the mines would become a lot safer.
Well, they certainly would, and you know that I've certainly met coal mine operators and owners who feel that way about their workers, and you know we're talking broadly here, but I've met wonderful guys who run small mines who, you know, would never think of putting their workers in danger. But by and large, as I mentioned before, this is a commodity business, and the interest is getting the coal out quickly and cheaply. And anything that gets in the way of that, it's just like, you know, money being taken out of your bank account. And that essential mindset is, you know, part of the problem here.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Do you know, Mr. Goodell, what percentage of miners in the United States are unionized and how many not?
Well, the Mine Workers Union claims that they represent about 30% of the mine workers in America right now. People dispute that and say that it's even less. And the majority of those miners that are in the Mine Workers Union are older miners. You see, for example, Wyoming, which is the Wyoming Powder River Basin, which is the real boom town for coal right now. They have enormous 70-foot seams of coal there and enormous coal mines. They're all surface mines, not underground mines. That is entirely non-union. Operators in Appalachia, the operator of the Alma mine, the one where the two men died recently when the conveyor belt caught fire, is run by a coal mine operator named Don Blankenship, who runs Massey Energy. who's been notorious for breaking the unions at the coal mines, shutting them down, reopening them as, with non-union crews. It's been a long campaign that they've gone through to break these unions.
We have another caller. This is also someone in Indiana, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering, I'd like to get this at the Boost Group. Have you know, just some possibilities, have you considered doing other study or, you know, something in regard to other regulatory outfits? I am in a city where IBP more or less controls everything. And anecdotally, I haven't heard anything too much about them cutting corners or anything. So I'm wondering if this rollback of regulations and, you know, just checking people out, basically, and having less people to do it and spread them thin, is this the predominant in industrial, you know, quasi-industrial outfits? Because I'm sure here in town, if anybody tried anything, there would, you know, you would hear about it very quickly through the grapevine. And you wouldn't have to worry about, you know, worry about a national outfit finding out about it. They, it seems to be pretty decent here. I just bring this up because I try to be fair with the Boost Group. It's awfully hard to find, you know, any light in that gloom. And I was just wondering if you've been able to tie this into other areas where regulations are pretty important for the safety of a worker. You know, there's a lot of things besides mines where you can get zapped, killed, or whatever because somebody decides not to fix something. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, can you talk about that?
Well, sure. I mean, I unfortunately have not been able to. I just haven't had the sort of time to look at this more broadly with worker safety. I'm sure that, you know, this is a common theme in other industries too. But I have looked at it throughout the coal industry in the sense of not just worker safety, but rollbacks on pollution regulations for, say, for example, for dirty power plants. There was a very complicated and controversial rollback of air pollution laws called New Source Review, which allowed older coal plants, like the Baldwin plant, was one of the major ones in outside of St. Louis, where the industry argued that air pollution regulations didn't apply to these old plants and wanted to keep them running. And it was the Department of Justice brought suit against a number of these plants. And the Bush administration has essentially nullified these suits and allowed these coal plants to keep operating. And you've seen sort of, and then there's the broad resistance to any kind of regulations against greenhouse gases or global warming, carbon dioxide emissions from coal plants, which are enormous. The Bush administration has been very resistant to that. I mean, there's a broad sense of giving these guys more room to run that I've noticed that the mine safety rollbacks are certainly a piece of.
We are at our midpoint here. Our guest, let me again introduce, is Jeff Goodell. He's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and also frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine. He's the author of another book that has to do with a mine accident. The book is titled Our Story, 77 Hours That Tested Our Friendship and Our Faith, based upon the experience of 9 miners who were trapped for a period of time underground. He also wrote a book entitled The Cyber Thief and the Samurai, which was about the hunt for the notorious computer hacker Kevin Mitnick. And he has a book that it will be coming out later this spring. It's scheduled to be published in May by Houghton Mifflin that is about coal and about the coal industry. The book is titled Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. So you can look forward to that book if you'd like to read up on its subject. And here on the program, questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have someone here on a cell phone, someone here in our area, on line one. Hello.
Hello, sir. I'm calling, and I'm not bashful about vilifying the current Bush administration in terms of their radical anti-regulation stance. My expertise is in the area of environmental law. You've already alluded to New Source Review and global warming, but also in products liability. We have the Consumer Product Safety Commission has rolled back. OSHA, with the ergonomics rules of the Clinton administration, have been rolled back. And I wonder if we could look at West Virginia and Appalachia and sort of coin a phrase similar to what Thomas Frank did in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas? What's the matter with West Virginia? Bush carried West Virginia, and the Union have been devastated, as well as mine safety has been devastated with MSHA. I just see a total disregard for human safety at the workplace and for the collective bargaining power of unions in this radical administration. I'd like your comments on the remarks.
Well, I think that you bring up a great point there. I mean, I think that then this is I think you can't discuss this without discussing broader themes like lobbying and financial contributions. The fact is, the coal industry has been a huge contributor to the Bush administration election campaigns. West Virginia was broadly credited with providing the 5 electoral votes that got Bush elected in 2005 and making the difference. And it's no secret that the Bush administration felt like it owed a debt to West Virginia and did all it could to help the coal industry out there. But I think that, you know, the coal industry is very powerful politically, not only because of its long history of contributions, political contributions, and of being a part of the kind of regulatory apparatus both in the states and in Washington, but also because it has very powerful allies in the railroads, who are among the most notorious lobbying powerhouses. They haul a lot of coal, a lot of the railroads, Burlington Northern, Santa Fe, Union Pacific. Those are both huge coal hauling railroads that have enormous influence in Washington. You have electric power utilities, especially like Southern Company, a big utility in Atlanta, Georgia, that is very, very close to the Bush administration and very powerful. So you have this sort of very strong alliance that, you know, is really getting its way with the administration. And that's, I think, you know, I think you have to look at it very broadly politically to see where this comes from.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Let's go on to Urbana. Another caller here. This is line 2. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I just tuned in, and I tell my story to this gentleman. I have to tell you, I'm in my 80s, and this happened when I was probably in my, 7 or 8, 9 years old. So that's a long time ago, and that's when the mines were so terrible. And I had an uncle and an aunt and a family in West Virginia who were quite well-to-do. And one time in an elevator, I think it was in New York, but John L. Lewis and my uncle were in an elevator in a hotel, and John Lewis, was it John L. Lewis, John F. Lewis, something like that,
yep.
You know, that head of the union, he said to my uncle, "Howard, I will get you yet." And they knew each other. But John L. Lewis was starting the unions, hopefully, which I don't know enough about what I'm talking about, but I think the miners have a union. And I think this last disaster, you correct me, please, this last disaster, terrible, horrible, I don't think it was the miners were unionized. At least I heard that or read it in a magazine or something. Do you know, were they unionized, those miners? I think there are a lot of them that aren't unionized. Whatever.
Right.
I don't know if that's the correct word, but union members is miners.
Right, right. Both of these mines in West Virginia, that where the two tragedies have happened in the recent weeks, were non-union.
Oh, I just suspected that. Maybe I heard it in my sleep or something. But and John L. Lewis did get my uncle. He did. He brought him down, and Uncle Howard lost his mind, and he and his wife and my cousins left West Virginia and had to go back and live with her parents. So, and that was in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very well-to-do mine owners, but John L. Lewis, I guess, as he said to my Uncle Howard, "Howard, I'll get you yet," and whether he did or not, well, he did.
Right. Mm. Well, John Lewis was a very famous figure in American labor history, a very, you know, obviously very passionate. And what's interesting today is that there's really no one like that. There's no one who's really an outspoken advocate for mine safety. And you know, the mine labor history is incredibly complicated, and the mine workers' union has had its own political problems, and the struggles there are is another book entirely. But you know, you're seeing the consequences of this today, and without a union, it's very difficult for a coal miner to say, you know, this is a dangerous job. What, I don't want to go in there. And especially, you know, what really breaks my heart when I read about these guys who died in West Virginia is, and I know this from talking with many coal miners, including the Cue Creek miners, who I got to know very well, who were trapped in Pennsylvania in 2002, is, you know, they all have kids. Many of them have kids, and they're working a job that is well paid in the region where they live. They love where they live. And a lot of them actually love coal mining, and I get that. I've been in mines. I understand the romance of it. But, you know, they're often faced with the choice of, do I say something about these dangerous situations or that I have and possibly lose my job and, you know, not be able to feed my family or go to work at Walmart, or do I just keep my mouth shut and go to work? And it's a terrible choice some of these guys have to make.
Yeah. Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the caller. Others are welcome to join us. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think that one of the things that is true, or at least that I have read, is that the basic technology of mining, the way that it's done, has changed very little over the last, say, 100 years, which seems to raise the question, at least in my mind, could not we apply some more contemporary technology to the business of mining and make it safer, at the very least, for the miners? Now, maybe, again, people who are in the mine business would say that it's an issue of cost and there are trade-offs. But, I mean, what about that? Are there ways in which people think that by making changes in the technology, using more modern technology and methods, that mining could be it's never going to be made completely safe. It's always going to be dangerous. But that things that could be done that could make it safer.
Well, there certainly is, and you know, let me say two things about this. One is that mining has changed in, you know, 100 years. You're not down, there's no guys down there with, you know, picks anymore hitting at the coal seams. You know, they have in underground mines, they have these large mechanical miners with these carbide bits that are sort of like large buzz saws that cut the coal, and they have haul trucks and things like the roof bolting machinery that allows them to put these bolts up into the roof to protect them and keep the roof from falling have changed a lot. And I mean, there's been a lot of improvements in the mining industry, and that's to their credit. And you're seeing in the aftermath of these two tragedies in West Virginia, the governor of West Virginia just passed a law that require coal mines to have better air tanks to improve the technology for communication. So, yes, there's lots of things that can be done technologically to make coal mining safer. But the essential point is not technological. It is political. The problem really with the coal industry and the danger of the coal industry is a problem of political influence. And until that gets addressed, coal mining is going to be dangerous.
All right, let's talk with some others. Next, I believe, would be Urbana Line number 1. Hello.
Yeah, hi. What percentage of the coal in the United States is shaft mined versus open pit mining like in the West? Do you know that number?
Well, underground versus...
Yeah, like open pit out in Wyoming and Utah and places like that. I'm sure.
Right.
You know.
I think the latest numbers, I think it's about 60% surface mine and 40% underground. Wyoming now, the most surprising statistic is that Wyoming now supplies 40% of the coal in the United States, and that's a huge number because there basically wasn't any coal mining going on there until the mid-70s, and so they've really taken away the market from Appalachia.
Yeah, so that would feed into the railroads because I think that's probably shipped to the East Coast. But also, do you address the this whole Orwellian idea that, or the term, the Clean Coal Initiative? I mean, I know it just sounds so like doublespeak, from 1984, but I mean, the they're trying to talk about injecting CO2 from these, like University of Illinois here has a coal-fired plant, and if on a real cold day, it just keeps spewing. It's visibly it's obvious more in the cold days. But do you address that issue in your book too, or the terminology they use?
Yeah, I do. I talk about it a lot, and the coal industry is one of the hallmark qualities of the coal industry today is that they're very good at touting high-tech technology and very bad at actually putting it to work. You hear a lot of talk about future gen, about sequestration, about improvements in air pollution technology, and some of it is true. I mean, there's no question that coal plants are cleaner today. But in general, they're very good at touting this and not so good at actually making it, and actually building it.
Making it sound good versus execution.
Right.
Because I was thinking that with modern computerization and mechanization, you could actually machine coal underground with, computerized, like robotic things. But I don't know. I'm just, it sounds really interesting. And I've read your stuff in Rolling Stone before, and I really appreciate your work. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Well, maybe I should just again real quickly introduce our guest, Jeff Goodell. He's contributing editor at Rolling Stone. He's also a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine, and he is the author of a book about the coal industry, which is scheduled to be published later this spring in May by Houghton Mifflin. The title of the book is Big Coal. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And next we'll talk with someone in Marseilles, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
In all of your concern about the political influences, hasn't Robert Byrd been senator from West Virginia forever?
He certainly has.
And during both Republican and Democratic administrations?
Mm-hmm.
And why has he not been responsible for any of this failure in mine safety?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that it's difficult to hold any one person responsible, especially a senator like this. Byrd is a very interesting figure who has very complicated views about this. And it's been interesting to see him in the aftermath of this, as he's really come out very forcefully. He made a very fiery speech on the Senate floor the other day. Saying where was MSHA, what's going on here, and I think that Byrd, my sense is that Byrd is coming at the end of his term in the Senate here, and I think that he's getting much tougher on this, on the coal industry in general. He's even voiced some qualified support for carbon dioxide limitations, under sympathy for global warming, legislation, which is remarkable coming from someone like him. So, yes, he's responsible in some ways, but it's really, a federal problem, and he's been torn between supporting the industry and doing the right thing for a long time.
That's not very persuasive when he's been there this long and not concerned for his people any more than that.
Yeah, well, he's this senator from West Virginia. He's been a big coal supporter for a long time. But I give him, as a big coal state politician, I really give him points for speaking out on what are for him quite difficult issues, and he's shown more courage than many politicians from big coal states in addressing some of these things.
At last.
Well, even before, he's been forthright about, more forthright than many.
Well, as powerful as he's been, it seemed like he could have done a lot more a long time ago if he really had his heart in it.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. And you know, I haven't spoken to him in years, and you know, I don't know if he regrets any of that or not. But it's just been interesting to see him how progressive he's been lately on some of this stuff. So,
okay,
all right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go to Champagne next. This is line number three. Hello.
Yeah, could you give a preview of your upcoming book? I guess I get the sense that the things that we've dealt with the petroleum industry, we're going to now deal with the coal industry, and probably some pushbacks on environment and a whole bunch of other things, I would assume.
Yeah, when you say the things we've dealt with the petroleum industry, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, you know, the favored status that the petroleum industry has had, and I don't know, this energy bill that came through, it seemed like it was, you know, all these big companies rather than going for cleaner
right.
alternative and all that kind of stuff. So it sounds like the beat's going to continue on and get louder and push against the environment again. You know?
Yeah. Well, I think the interest, you know, the big question with coal is, you know, as oil peaks and oil prices go up and natural gas prices have been very high, obviously, having affordable energy is very important to America, and we are blessed with, I mean, the coal industry likes to call America the Saudi Arabia of coal, and it's true, we have a lot of coal, but and that's a great thing, but it's sort of a blessing and a curse, because on one hand, you know, it does allow us a lot of affordable electricity, and there are a lot of people now talking about using coal to create natural gas, to liquefy it, to use it for synthetic diesel. A lot of people think that coal is the answer to America's energy problems. And my basic argument is that, you know, coal is a blessing and a curse, because, yes, it does allow us a lot of our bounty of coal does give us a lot of freedom, gives us things that Europe and other countries don't have. But at the same time, you know, coal is a environmentally incredibly destructive. It's one of the most destructive things we do on this planet is mine and burn coal. And with the reality of global warming, I think that no one can deny that the science is real. Coal has enormous challenges with that. It is by far the most greenhouse gas intensive of all fossil fuels. And I think that how we use our bounty of coal in the next, you know, 10 or 20 years, whether we burn it intelligently and mine it safely and do what's necessary to sequester, if that's possible, the carbon dioxide, or whether we just allow it, you know, mine it in an exploitive way, continue building old-fashioned coal plants, is going to be one of the great questions America's going to face in the next 20 years.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Let's talk with somebody obviously listening on the Internet there in San Francisco. Line 2. Hello.
Yeah, how are you? Just as I'm calling across state lines, there are many of these issues across state lines. You had a previous caller who was talking about why Byrd wasn't able to essentially gather a steamrolling effort to deal with many of these issues. That's because he's only one out of 100, and trying to get big money to do anything intelligent is enormously dangerous and difficult. I wanted to ask about two different aspects of this international or at least state line issue, putting it in the concept of the old colony idea that damages can be wrought from afar. In other words, back in 1776, King George III would demand that the colonies do something that may not be feasible, but just because he ordered it, everybody had to dance to that tune. So with that in mind, I wonder if you're aware of mining technology that has essentially caused problems nationally or internationally. For example, there's some discussion right now about whether or not the oil drilling in the Indian Ocean created a huge cavern, When they emptied it out, this huge cavern collapsed and created the tsunami of a year ago. And whether or not the, I believe it's Exxon, is responsible for that oil drilling problem. And then the pricing, that various of these poverty-ridden states, they may be entirely, if you looked at the amounts of energy, coal and some of the other technologies are able to produce, you know, West Virginia should be a very wealthy state, but the fact that the commodities market demands that coal go for a given price sets it so that, that West Virginia not only has to undergo a huge amount of environmental damage and human suffering from black lung and a lot of other damages. So the idea that the pricing structure of coal is essentially causing enormous problems. By the way, a little side note, California is just about to do another vote on a, I believe we're looking at a $3 billion alternative energy, predominantly a solar bond issue. And that should goose the solar industry for the rest of the nation. And so if people are looking at opportunities, financial opportunities, they should be looking at solar, among others.
Well, that caller raises a number of questions. Mr. Goodall, can you talk about some of that?
Well, there is a lot to talk about there, but let me just talk about one thing, which I think is really important, and that is the idea of price. I think that the caller really nails it in a certain way. One of the things, and you're seeing it in Illinois now with the cost of electricity starting to rise as deregulation gets underway. But one of the things that has always been in coal's advantage is, and that the coal industry, both the electric power companies who burn coal and the people who mine the coal say, is, you know, coal provides cheap energy to America, and America needs cheap energy. But what in fact has happened is that the coal industry has been very good at keeping the real costs of that energy away from us. The coal industry, and by this I mean, again, electric power people and the mining people, want you to turn on the light switch and not think about where that power comes from. And they want you to just look at your bill and for the cost of the kilowatt to be cheap and for you to just, you know, keep turning on lights and not really worry about it. The fact about coal is that because of their political power, they've been able to keep, you know, the destructiveness to the environment, the destructiveness to the planet in the sense of the rising global the rising carbon dioxide levels out of people's consciousness. And I think that that is going to change. And I think that, you know, as the caller said, if coal were the ticket to sort of coal mining, especially were the ticket to economic prosperity, West Virginia should be, you know, people in West Virginia should be dancing on gold-paved streets right now. I mean, you know, they've mined 14 billion tons of coal out of that state over the last 120 years. And it's, you know, right now it's one of the most economically depressed regions in America. It's ranked virtually last in education, in job creation, in many, many categories. And the fact is it is a commodity business where the money from the coal goes to the corporate owners and to the people who profit from selling the electricity of the coal and does not really get shared by the communities. And I think that, you know, Wyoming has been very good at addressing this with things like a mineral tax to help build a fund for when coal gets out, it runs out. But these kinds of things are going to be a subject, I think, of much debate in the coming years.
All right. We're very short on time. I want to thank the caller and try to get a little bit, at least one more here, give him the chance. Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, since there's just a moment, I'd like to point out that this, the last accident where two people died can be tied directly to the retrenchment of regulations. There was a variance given for them to allow to ventilate through the area where their conveyor belt was. They were allowed to do that, and several years ago there was an attempt to get non-flammable conveyor belts installed, and it was abruptly stopped by the Bush administration, and that's where the fire was, and that's why the smoke spread through the mine. So it's directly linked, it seems to me.
And that's exactly right. And, you know, it's interesting that the governor of West Virginia is quite outspoken about that right now, and I think that you know, that is really going to be looked into a lot. You know, that, and it's, but it's typical. I mean, it's not unusual. That is happening broadly throughout the industry.
What's amazing is to have watched the this hearing that was recently chaired by Spector, where the head of MSHA left early. Astonishing. You know, it seems like if anybody should have stayed and fully answered questions, it should have been a guy who's, you know, got this on his docket.
I know. That was an astonishing moment and symbolic of the kind of arrogance of that some of this industry has. I mean, it was really astonishing. You're right. You know, here they are trying to kind of come to terms with and even, you know, to come to terms with these accidents and being held responsible here with a Senate hearing, and these guys just walk out. It was really amazing.
Well, this was nominally a Bush official, but I think he had come right out of industry, so the point is still valid. Seems to me, though, the Commerce Clause and the interpretation, the maximalist interpretation of the federal, or the minimalist interpretation by the federalists, is that it only applies to navigable waters. So these coal companies can have their externality of dumping the top of mountaintops on the hollers onto the streams with impunity, if that's the kind of interpretation is given to the Commerce Clause, that it's only about commerce. It's not about the commerce of these large corporations having this as a economic possibility called an externality. It's not an externality to somebody who's downstream drinking the poisons that accumulate in the water.
Right, and you know, there's been a big fight about this with the in West Virginia about the reclassification of the debris from mountaintop removal from waste to fill, and that's been, there's a couple of lawsuits going on about that right now, and that's just one aspect of the broader externalities. You know, it doesn't even begin to talk about acid mine drainage, which is causing large problems with the drinking water supply in a lot of coal mining regions, all the air pollution issues, and then the big kahuna, which is global warming. And that's really the thing that the coal industry needs to address and is the most afraid of, and potentially the most it can really stop coal, you know, sort of in its track.
We're, pardon me for jumping in on you there, but we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. Jeff Goodell, contributing editor at Rolling Stone, the book, you can look for it in May, that we've been talking about, is Big Coal, the Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. Thanks very much.
Thank you.